0818 715 815.
Hello, good afternoon, and you're very welcome to Liveline. Five one double 51 is our text number. Normal numbers apply. 0818 715 815. And Joe with RT.ie. On this day, 100 years ago, Michael Collins would have been reading the front of the Cork Examiner as he left the Imperial Hotel this morning, so to speak, at 6 a.m. The front of the Examiner reads, "Cork stands. Cork stands intact. And if you come to town, you will find the stores as ready to serve you and as active as usual." That's from Roach's Stores in 14, 15 and 16 Patrick Street in Cork. Nat Ross, according to this ad, is the best remover. And if you want chocolates in Cork, go to F.H. Thompson and Sons for the best bonbons and boxes of chocolates at all prices. And if you want the best tablecloths and the mask, go to Dowden's in Patrick Street. You know it well. For 19 and 6, you will get 20 dozen Supervine serviettes, 20-inch square, woven with a shamrock and ribbon border and spotted centre, and the 20 dozen will cost you 19 and 6. Now, they're not your paper serviettes that we know today. They're actually woven. They're 19 and 6, a dozen. They've gone up since last week. Furniture bargains for cash in 8, 9 and 10 Corn Market Street. Michael Collins would have had this letter, I suspect, not just in his hand, but also in his mind as he travelled around Cork today. 100 years ago, he received this letter from Kitty Kearn and his fiancée just 5 days ago.
"My own darling Michael, poor Griffith's funeral is too awful for me to think of. May he rest in peace. Was he prepared, I wonder? When that hour comes, what good is anything else? We are just all bits of dust, the great as well as the small. He will be a loss to you. I can picture it. How unfortunate it should happen just now. He was, poor man, evidently overworked and took no holiday, or at least not in time. I am always thinking of you and worrying. And just tonight somebody said, if you go to the funeral tomorrow, you'll be shot. But God is very good to you, and we must both do Loch Derg sometime in Thanksgiving. Did you ever hear of it? It's very hard. I did it 3 times already. I'm sure you'll think this is a sermonising kind of letter. I'm very lonely tonight and hate to have to go to old Belfast. Yet I only want you and wish to be near you. I'd love in the ordinary way to be going. Tom Set are more than nice and I have a few friends there. But I've got a feeling that I'll be lonely this time and not interested. But it's not fair to bore you with this. I know all you have to contend with, or rather, I'd rather not know at all. Are you lonely for me or too busy and too worried to think? I'll send you a kiss with my love. Yours, Kitty."
And Michael Collins will be dead a few days later. Tim Crowley of the Michael Collins Centre, Clonakilty in West Cork. Tim, good afternoon on this fateful day, 100 years good later, afternoon. On this fateful date, 100 years later. Where is Michael Collins now at this time on this date?
We're talking about 1:45. I suppose he's in Clonakilty for lunch. Mm-hmm. The convoy had come from had driven from the Imperial on through Coulter onto Macroom. They came from Macroom to Benben, and of course they drove through Ben Le Blanc. They were spotted driving through there by anti-treaty people, and then the convoy had gone from into Benben and then on to Clonakilty. And it is said one of Michael Collins' young soldiers in the convoy that day from up the country had never come across the women wearing the West Cork hooded cloaks. And, of course, an awful lot of the Clonakilty women at the time would have been wearing those. And the soldier seemingly said to an officer, "Are they an order of nuns or what?" And the officer said back, "Be very careful, as many as the revolver came out from underneath one of them."
I can imagine.
He was right, because during the War of Independence, the Cumbernauan ladies in Clonakilty used to smuggle the revolvers underneath the cloaks for the IRA lads.
But at this time, 10 minutes to 2, has Michael Collins' fate already been sealed?
Well, the anti-treaty IRA, of course, he'd driven through in the morning, and the anti-treaty IRA were having meetings in the Bay on the Blanc area by pure coincidence. And when the convoy came in around 9 o'clock past the pub at down the block crossroads, an anti-treaty sentry had seen them. The word was passed on to the local anti-treaty officers, and they had the meeting, and they decided that if the convoy came back in the evening, they would have an ambush waiting for them. So they definitely, the ambush would have been in situ at this particular time 100 years ago.
And let's go to the house as such where the ambush is being planned. Niall Murray is a direct descendant of the Murrays, Bill and Mary Ann Murray, whose safe house was being used this time by the anti-treaty forces in Cork. Niall, who was in your house, your grandparents' house at this time?
Hi, Joe. Yeah, at this stage in the day, they were probably just wrapping up or near ending or had just ended their meeting. It would have been mainly officers of what was the West Cork IRA Brigade, so men like Tom Hales and others, and others from the kind of Bandon and West Cork battalions of the IRA, joined by more senior officers from the IRA First Southern Division, which would cover most of Munster, including Liam Deasy, who himself was a West Cork man. And they had been, as Tim was just saying, they'd by pure coincidence been arranged to meet there on that same day that Collins passed through earlier on. But it in ways it wasn't a huge coincidence, because even any good intelligence reports would have told Michael Collins that he really was passing through the heartland of anti-treaty territory. Not only had Cork been evacuated, but many of the forces who had evacuated Cork City a week or two earlier had gone to Macroom Castle, and it was only three or four days before this again, before this day 100 years ago, that Macroom Castle was evacuated, and many of the mid-Cork forces were occupying the farmhouses and the farmlands around where Béal na Bláth lies and the border between Mid and West Cork.
If the irregulars had got their hands on the Cork Examiner from today, 100 years ago, they would have almost read his itinerary, as Michael Collins did this morning. The headline read on page 3, General Collins in Cork, National troops advance, Bandon occupied after short fight, irregulars, futile ambushes, Lismore Castle saved, arrests in Cork, Southern Rail position, and then it goes into General Michael Collins is in Cork, and he's going to inspect in association, they say, with military affairs, and is visiting various troops and is heading out to Bandon. They would have read that in the newspaper. But Niall, was it a big house with so many people at that meeting? Describe the house to me.
Yeah, it's the house still stands. It's farmed still by my father's cousin Tom and Louise and their family, and it's the original farmhouse would probably be a medium sized big sized farmhouse in that day. It would have had been a large five or six windows to the front and outbuildings attached to either side, and on a hillside in an area that was fairly prosperous with dairy farming at that stage through the local co-op. So yeah, it was a big house, and it was accustomed at that stage in 1922 to hosting big groups of men, not just for meetings, but as early as 1916, volunteers from around the Kinsale and South Cork area had billeted there overnight in the storm when they had been turned around at Macroom. They were supposed to have taken part in the rising, so it was no small labourer's cottage like many of the uh-huh. those houses that were also used in these times as safe houses, but it was one of many dozen in this whole mid Cork area that would have been, particularly during these early stages of the Civil War, heavily occupied by IRA, those who had left other areas and urban towns that had been captured by the National Army at this stage, as Michael Collins's army colleagues began to take hold of Munster after the fighting in Dublin. So, and it was in regular use, as were many houses around the place, for training and meeting and the exchange of messages. And in fact, this wasn't, even though these were West Cork Brigade officers who were holding the meeting, they were actually inside the Mid Cork Brigade area, but such was the cooperation and it being on that border area. And in fact, I need to check the small print, even the new Michael Collins diaries that have been released by the National Archives recently. But I know that Michael Collins was in this very area. He was certainly in the neighbouring Kilmichael Parish in the early days of 1919 when he came down from Irish Volunteers headquarters to reorganise the IRA battalions and stuff. So it may well be that morning of the 22nd of August wasn't the first time he'd been driven through.
But was your grandparents' house? Was it known as an anti-treaty house? Was it well known that this was a spot for irregulars to gather and train and meet?
Well, it would have been known certainly in the local area, but it would depend among the National Army officers who they had intelligence from. I think, as Tim mentioned, there are many of the convoy and travelling with Michael Collins would have been soldiers who came with him from Dublin and were from up the country. Emmett Dalton, who was in command of Cork and the surrounding areas, had been there for a couple of weeks, but they might not have had the exact intelligence on which houses to know, but they would certainly have been given direction as to which areas and which were more heavily anti-treaty than not. Although again, in those, it was relatively early in the Civil War at that stage, and intelligence.
But there was strong anti-treaty in that.
Oh, hugely, yes, even Armalek was only further. That. Further west, Erskine Childers was holed up from August through until October, November, publishing his anti-treaty publicity newspapers from the valleys around Rennery and Coolay and the what we now know as the Musqueam Gaeltacht. You know, so it was well established even since before the War of Independence began as a place for people outside the area to come and lay low, and where Crown forces were loath to travel and did very few raids during the War of Independence that preceded, because they knew they were in hostile territory in terms of a largely Republican population who were more than less likely than other areas to give information or to.
And just you mentioned Erskine Childers. One of the soldiers in the Crossley tender in Michael Collins' convoy in Bain na Blaa, we'll be talking to a relative of his shortly. One of the soldiers, obviously the only casualty, the only fatality in Collins' convoy was himself and a dispatch rider who was wounded but survived. But 3 months later, one of the soldier survivors of Collins' group took part in the firing squad that shot Erskine Childers at Beggar's Bush Barracks in Dublin. That's how awful that these are former comrades, former best men at each other's wedding. But let's go back to the day. Stay with us, Niall, and your picture of the house. How far are we from Bain na Blaa, that image yesterday? How far is the house from Bain na Blaa?
It would be back it would be back closer to the, for those who know the area, the monument and the battle site is about a half a mile south of the crossroads. The Moray House would have been slightly to the other side of the crossroads.
For a group of men to walk, it, how long would it take?
To walk to the Ambrose site, yes. about 10, wow. At a good pace, 10 minutes really, wow. 10
so
or 15
close,
minutes.
How close were they? Deirdre Bourke, Deirdre, good afternoon.
Hello, Joe.
Your great-grandparents' house, this date 100 years ago, was very relevant to sealing Michael Collins' fate. What happened?
It was my grandparents' house, actually, but when Collins' convoy left from Macroom en route to Bandon for the first time, to before they ever arrived at Bain na Blaa, they had picked up a local guide in Macroom, a man called Kelleher, because the main road from Macroom to Bandon was down, had been damaged by the irregulars. So they were being guided through back roads. And one of the back roads came directly past the farm at Ballymichael, which is at the bottom of a steep hill.
Okay.
And the armoured car broke down outside the family farm.
Okay.
And Collins walked in to the yard to borrow horses to help pull the armoured car up the hill.
Okay.
Which was potentially tricky.
Yeah.
Because my grandmother's family in particular were very strongly Republican and very anti-treaty.
Yeah.
And it was the anniversary of the day that her brother had been killed in an ambush against the British forces in Lisada. So feelings would have been fairly.
So what was that? The War of Independence, maybe two years previously.
2 years previously, okay. During the War of Independence. So in 1920.
Yeah, shows you all the connections. So your grandmother is mourning her brother, obviously a young man, I suspect.
Yes.
Michael Galvin, into the yard struts Michael Collins.
Now, Michael Collins walks through the yard and up to the door of the house.
Okay.
And just before he knocks on the door, the troops who have been told to get off the Crossley tender and push. Mm-hmm. And the Crossley tender pulling managed to get the armoured car restarted.
Okay.
So they turn round and go. Michael Collins turns around and goes back out. But my grandmother recognised him.
Ah.
Because he was quite well known, mm-hmm, in the area. Not very well known personally, but he would have been well known because many of the, as Niall was saying, you know, he was involved in setting up the 3rd West Cork Brigade when the Cork Brigade was split in three. But anyway, my mother asked her, would she have lent horses? And she said, well, you know, although it was Collins and I wouldn't have wanted to lend him horses, mm-hmm, at the same time, in a rural area, you were asked for help in that way. It's just not the done thing not to give help.
Okay.
So I would have felt I had to lend the horses. But I had decided I'd play for time for a bit and tell him that I needed to ask my husband, and he was on the other side of the land.
Okay. But her blood was high. She was, as a lot of people were, there was so much baggage. The revolutionist stuff had been going on now since 1916, on and off, War of Independence and the Civil War. And lots of activity in the Cork area. So everyone has burdens and ghosts on their shoulders.
Cork had faced the most reprisals of any county.
Yeah, yeah. So who's Dinny the Dane Long?
Dinny the Dane Long. Tim Crowley mentioned that when they went through Bear the Blaw that the convoy was spotted. Essentially, they were spotted by a fellow called Dinny the Dane Long.
Yeah.
And the convoy came through Bear the Blaw, which is kind of a complicated crossroads with side roads. There were no signposts. And they stopped to ask directions of a young fella,
mm-hmm,
just outside Long's Pub, which is just on the crossroads. And they just thought he was, you know, hanging about.
Yeah.
But he was actually on sentry duty because of that meeting, which was scheduled to take place later.
Across in the Murray's house.
That's right. So yeah. Murray's house would be a bit further back, perhaps 100 yards back. I don't know. Niall would give you a better sense of that. But there was already officers who were being billeted at Long's, gathered in Long's Pub.
Okay.
So when the convoy came past and they asked what is the correct road, the best road for Bandon, and Dinny the Dane indicated the correct road for them to take,
mm-hmm,
and waited till the convoy was out of sight, at which point he fished his gun out of the ditch and headed back in to tell the officers that Collins and his men were headed for Bandon.
And this would have been quite early in the morning.
About between 9 and 9:30.
Wow, this morning. So they know, they well know now that it is Michael Collins, that he is in the area. They have an idea of the strength of his convoy, which is not all that great. And they don't, I know, that obviously lots of the bridges have been blown by the irregulars to bring as much mayhem or whatever to the opposition. Yeah. But to go back to stay with us, dear, Tim Crowley. Tim, like, who was in this car? How come they didn't know their way round?
Well, I suppose Michael Collins came from the Clonakilty area and, we do tours and so on that we've been doing for 25 years. But to be honest, until I started doing them back in the day, I'm from Clonakilty myself, I wouldn't have been that familiar with the roads around the Bear na Blaw area. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of countryside up there. So they picked up this man, Dinny, he was Tim Keller in Macroom, and he was a local hackney driver there. And so he brought along the convoy as far as Bandon. Now, my own theory is that the mm-hmm. convoy, I think, got split up at Ballymichael, or close to that, because...
This is where Deirdre Bourke's house is.
That's right.
Yeah.
Because there is a reference that the motorcycle scout going up through Kilmorey village, which would be beyond Ballymichael, that he started talking to people on the side of the street there, telling them that the commander in chief was coming.
Oh, good luck.
And it seems that the motorcycle scout went ahead, and possibly and definitely the troop lorry. Because what puzzled me is when the convoy came to the crossroads at Bail na Blaw, why did they have to stop for directions if they had a guide with them? Well, my theory is that the motorcycle scout and the troop lorry had gone ahead, heading up towards the Newstown direction, and then Michael Collins' car a few seconds later, followed by the armour car, pulls into the crossroads, five roads, where do we go from here? Oh, there's Dinny Didane, we'll ask him. Well, they didn't know who he was, but he would have given them the directions. So I think, because we know for definite that about 2 to 3 miles further on, beyond the Bail na Blaw crossroads, the convoy was definitely split up, because one, the motorcycle scout followed by the troop lorry went straight on to Bandon, and Conza's car and the armoured car took a right and went over to Newstown.
And where did Dinny Didane, do we know anything about Dinny Didane Long? Where did the name come from, for a start?
I think there was a few Dinnis Longs around at the time, and I suppose to differentiate him from the others, he was given the name Dinny Didane.
I understand that. As Tim has just said, he was one of, there were several Long families in the area. He was no relation to Long's own the bar, but even in the Pollerick townland close by where he came from, he was one of, I think maybe 3 young men in their 20s aged named Dinnis Long. Another was Dinnis James or Dinny Jimmy Long, and I think the Dane may have come from his fair hair, but again I'm open to correction on that.
Well, let's go back into your house then, Niall. A few 10 minutes walk from Bail na Blaw, quite close to this pub. Dinny Didane Long is on, he's mooching about, but actually he's on sentry duty. He has a gun hidden in the ditch, and he's the one who spots. He's on sentry duty because of the meeting going on in your house.
That's right.
Now, in your who of your family who was in the house, and.
I don't know exactly who was there, but certainly there would have been my great-grandparents, Bill and Mary Ann. Mary Ann was possibly more Republican than anybody else in the district. Her brother was a Father Patrick O'Connell who blessed Tom Barry's flying column the night before the Kilmichael ambush, but they later fell out over the Civil War. That's another story.
I want that story in a minute.
My grandfather, William Murray, was then a 16-year-old. He was one of about probably 5 or 6 children in the house in their late teens or early 20s. He and his brother, John or Jackie, who was 21, and the local IRA intelligence officer. Their sister, Lena, was a 19-year-old in the local Cumann na Mon branch. So it was almost a typical house, it was typical of many houses in that whole Mid Cork and West Cork area throughout the period. But obviously, I think in Cork, the numbers who remained on duty were stronger than in many other places.
But all of the children and the parents in the house and the children, and they're young adults that we're talking about, Willie, Uncle Jack, 21, they're all in the irregulars. They're all anti-treaty.
They would have been anti-treaty.
Then the your mother's brother, Father Patrick O'Connell, later Canon O'Connell, how did he fall out with them?
So he was famously a Republican priest in the during the War of Independence.
Okay.
He had been based in Enniskeen, Ballineen, and later a canon there. But he would have been friendly with and assisted the flying the West Cork flying column led by Tom Barry. Tom Barry was in prison at this stage during the Civil War, but. It turned out that I hear from relatives that after the ambush at Bail na Blaw, at which stage this Father O'Connell, my great granduncle, had turned pro-treaty, as I think did a lot of the Catholic priests or who had been Republican during the War of Independence. He came to the Murray House to try and remonstrate, having heard that they had somehow been involved in the ambush, or the ambush had been planned there, as word would have circulated locally. But he was swiftly shown the door by his sister, my great-grandmother, and told never to darken the door again. And
well, that's some statement to make to a padre, isn't it, in those days?
Oh, yes, yeah, yeah. Well, I think, as I say, I think she was no lady to be messed with. I've seen there's still a photograph of her, a framed photo of her.
Imagine running the priest, home. Who was a relative, you were running the priest. That's how deep the fissures were, isn't it?
And this was a family who had at least sent two daughters to become nuns, you know, so they were... Yeah. It wasn't like they were anti-religious or anything like that, but in some houses, I guess, some things like politics even trumped religion, you know.
And where was De Valera now?
So at this stage of the morning, as some listeners may probably know at this stage, Eamon De Valera, again, another coincidence, but again, given as I was mentioning earlier, the level of senior IRA personnel who were in the broader district, Eamon De Valera, who was... a political leader in the Republican movement, but had no real military influence.
Yeah.
But he had been in the Mid Cork and West Cork area, trying to just, I suppose, get a feeling on the ground of what the mood was towards any idea of trying to end what was starting to become a very bloody civil war. He had been, it depends on which version you read, but he had stayed in one of. A number of houses that have been suggested in the area. So he essentially stayed somewhere within a few miles of Béal na Bláth the night before Michael Collins and his convoy drove through there. And as Deirdre was just saying, it was probably around 9 o'clock or so when Michael Collins and his crew drove through and departed Béal na Bláth. It's said to be, again, varying accounts tell us the time, but it was certainly within about an hour. It may have even been less than half an hour later that, accompanied by Liam Deasy, as a senior IRA officer, that Eamon De Valera was brought by pony and trap to Béal na Bláth, knowing or having heard that the West Cork Brigade officers were meeting. So he would have wished to get their views on the military situation and the lie of the land with them.
There seemed to be an undercurrent. And I talked to Tim about Mike Conn's visit to Maryborough Prison 2 days ago on his way to Cork. But there seemed to be undercurrents both on Dev's side and Colin's side. We need to end this madness.
There may well have been, although as I was saying, Dev, being more the political, had little sway or influence over the military people. And
interesting.
And it's well documented that Liam Lynch, who was the chief of staff of the IRA, also a Corkman but based up around North Cork, he was in the Mallow area at this time, had been leaving Eamon De Valera in no doubt that he wasn't for calling any halt to the hostilities.
Okay.
But as it so when De Valera came, however soon, but probably within an hour, within the hour of Collins's passing through, Eamon De Valera arrived at Béal na Bláth and was being brought up to the Murray's farmhouse.
Okay. But the fact that he goes to your house is coincidental.
It is, yeah, it is. Now, I know that it wasn't the only time he visited. He may well have been there at other stages, either before or after. But yeah, because I even remember hearing my grandfather, who died when I was only 12 in the 80s, telling me that, you know, stories of remember seeing him and knocking around the haggard, as he called it, the farmyard in front of the house. And there are various versions of what he said to have said when he learned that Collins had passed through. The one version that is passed down through my own family, and which one of my uncles was recounting to me just recently, was that that my grandfather remembers there was a kind of a stone step where one could cross the wall rather than opening the gate into the farmyard.
Yeah.
So as outside many country houses, that Dave was sat atop this stone step with his apparently his long legs dangling, and on hearing that Collins had just passed through a short time earlier, he was said to have said that's an awful pity. I'd been hoping to meet him the last few days, or words similar to that. Yeah. No. That could be interpreted as I don't think there was any plans in place for Dev to meet Collins.
Yeah, but it's an interesting comment. Tim Crowley, go back if you can, with me to 2 days ago, August the 20th. Collins' convoy leaves Portobello Barracks, now Conor Brewer Barracks in Dublin, late in the evening, and they stop at Port Leash prison. Now, there is one story that when he stopped at the prison to look at the conditions of the prisoners, most of them obviously would have been former comrades, he spoke to some prisoners, including Tom Malone, about ending the Civil War. He asked if Malone would attend a meeting to try to put an end to this damn thing. As he left, he slapped one fist into his hand and said, "That fixes it. The three Toms, Malone, Tom Barry and Tom Hales, will fix it." So what was Collins's purpose to visit West Cork that fateful day 100 years ago?
Well, there is, I suppose, a theory there that he was hoping to meet anti-treaty officers to secretly negotiate quick into the Civil War. I don't think there's any this huge solid evidence for that.
Okay.
There was a story. There was a story told that the housekeeper for the parish priest of Kilmurry, was a Canon Tracy at the time, that she was seen going to a local shop that day, and she bought a whole lot of sweet cake, jam, whiskey, as if they were expecting important visitors in the parish priest's house. And that kind of went out afterwards as maybe that there was a planned visit by Michael Collins to that house to meet some anti-treaty officers. But again, it's something I've never seen any strong evidence of. But, I mean, Collins, the day before he was shot, was above in Cork going home to Banks. And
he
located almost 100,000 pounds of anti-treaty funds, which he was trying to stab the anti-treaty side of their funds, as well as attacking them militarily. And then, the war, from his point of view, militarily, was going very well. I mean, a lot of observers, I think, would reckon if he'd lived on, the Civil War might well have ended by the Christmas of that year, which was for the pro-treaty side. But he wanted to see his commander-in-chief, but the military situation was on the ground, and obviously the personal reasons coming down, because this is where they grew up in West Cork.
Of course,
see what was happening. Yeah.
Remember, he was the other aspect of was, I'm thinking of, you mentioned him having lunch just half an hour ago in Clonakilty. He was a big eater. He loved a big, hearty Irish breakfast. It's reputed that his grandmother invented the recipe, which is now Clonakilty black pudding. His favourite meal, apparently, was breakfast, a big, hearty breakfast and strong tea with two sugars. He was a dapper dresser, as we all know. He loved the theatre. And apparently, we've been trying to verify this, Niall and Tim and Deirdre and the other people that are on the line that we went after the break. Apparently, he couldn't pronounce the word eggs. This is a story we got about 2 weeks ago. And when the British Army were chasing him in Dublin and they didn't know, I don't know how they didn't know, but didn't know what he looked like, if they grabbed a few fellas and they thought he might have been Michael Collins, they asked him to say how many eggs, repeat after me, how many eggs in a dozen. And this was one way, but whether that's true or not, we do not know. But he was a hearty man with a very, very full life, a very, very full life and great, great many skills. This is the letter Michael Collins wrote to his darling Kitty 20 days ago.
My own dearest Kitty, I mentioned about Harry in yesterday's letter. Last night I passed Vincent's hospital and saw a small crowd outside. My mind went into him lying there and I thought of the times together. And whatever good there is in any wish of mine, he certainly had it. Although the gap of 8 or 9 months was not forgotten, of course no one can ever forget it, I only thought of him with the friendship of the days of 1918 and 1919. They tell me that the last thing he said to his sister Kathleen before he was operated on was, "Have they got Mick Collins yet?" I don't believe it, so far as I'm concerned, and if he did say it, there is no necessity to believe it. I'd send a wreath, but I suppose they'd return it torn up. Please do come up as soon as you can. You'll excuse this letter. May God bless you. Fondest love, Michael.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815. Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
I'm just reading this morning's Cork Examiner. Tea delivered to your home by parcel post by Woodford Bourne and Company. They're limited. They're Cork and Limerick. I think they were also in Dublin at the time. And the prices are, there was a good couple of pound of tea for a shilling. And that would be delivered to your home, not by Amazon, but by parcel post 100 years ago. today. The City of Cork Steam Packet Company are advertising on the front of today's Examiner. Again, going to Cork to Bristol, Bristol to Cork, Cork to Liverpool, Cork to Plymouth, Southampton and London. Incredible journeys. Tim, now this morning we mentioned, Deirdre Burke mentioned the whole thing about the car breaking down outside her family home. But like there was trees felled, and there's a story about Collins himself getting out with the axe and clearing the way.
Yeah, that's right. That was between Balnaskerty and Clonakilty in the morning before lunch. Now, you pass through a place on that road, it's now the N71 Lissalan Estate, and that time there was an awful lot of trees at either side, okay. And some of the trees were chopped down blocking the road by the anti-treaty lads. So when Michael Collins' convoy came along, seemingly he got out of the car and gave his troops a hand with a hatchet, chopping up the trees. And they couldn't get over how skilled he was with the axe. But he was well used to being raised on a farm using implements like that. And then they actually came to a second place then where there was other trees blocking the road, and he reckoned there was too much work to remove them. So they went up a boreen and they actually came down the Timoleague Road opposite what's now Clonakilty Community Hospital. It was then the old workhouse, and that had been burned by the anti-treaty lads just days before. So that was a smouldering ruin because of the what was going on in the Civil War at the time.
And you mentioned Balnaskerty, because in 1922, Balnaskerty would have been becoming a little more well known because it was the home place of Henry Ford, who was making big waves in the States at the time. Obviously, he founded the Ford Motor Company in 1903. So Michael Collins, I presume William Ford, he emigrated in 1847 during the famine, and he was 27, and then Henry Ford was born, and then in 1917 Henry Ford set up the first factory outside North America, and that was in Cork. And if people now drive to Balnaskerty, they can see the replica Model T Ford in silver effectively, and Collins would have been on that. Michael Collins' convoy would have been on that route that day. Did he have much engagement? It's an open top car, so I presume as they went through villages and crossroads or people on the road, you'd invariably say hello to people from an open-top car, wouldn't you? And have the chats. Tim.
You would. Well, there's a few examples that day of him waving out of the car. Well, one great story was he was actually on the return journey. He was driving out of Bandon up Kilbrogan Hill, and there was a woman, Annie O'Leary, standing on the side of the street with a Kerry blue dog on a leash. And Michael Collins, as the convoy was passing, put his hand out over the side of the car, and he went to the dog and continued up the heading for Bayonne Law. So one of the last dogs he would have seen was a Kerry Blue, and of course he was a big fan of the Kerry Blue himself.
Oh, was he?
Yeah, he bred Kerry Blue dogs. One of them was called Bandit 224, which was his prison number in Sligo Jail in 1918.
Michael Collins bred Kerry Blue dogs.
That's right. And actually, Harry Boland, when Harry Boland went off to America the second time in October of 1921, he took two Kerry Blue dogs over for some members of the Irish community over in New York or whatever. And Michael also, I think, gave pups to one or two British politicians that he was kind of friendly with as well.
Okay, incredible bits of information. Michael O'Mahony. Michael, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joe.
You were directly related to the big fella.
Everything being local, Joe. Yeah. I'm sitting in Ard Navaha in Balnaskerty at the moment, looking at a Ford car in front of me here. Yeah,
incredible. Small world, isn't it? Small world. Tell us your connection and your memories, Michael.
Well, my grandfather was Johnny Collins, Michael's eldest brother, who was 12 years older than Michael. He was 1878 and Michael was 1890. And when their father died in 1897, Johnny was the sort of father figure, if you like, with an age gap of 12 years. Johnny had nine children. Michael, the first, died at age two. And then you had Mary, 1909, my mother, Kitty, 1910. Yeah. And then all the way down to Liam Collins, who was responsible for the Woodfield development in 1990 on the anniversary of Michael, the 100th year of Michael's birth in 1990. So Kitty was 10 at the time the house was burnt in Woodfield, and would have been just 11 at the time we're talking about, 22nd of August 1922.
And what did you hear of their memories of various people? I know some of them weren't actually there when Michael Collins called, but what were their memories as told to you over the years of that day?
Well, they rarely talked about it, either Mary, who was Mary Pierce afterwards from the Stole, or mm-hmm. Kitty, my mother, who was Kitty O'Mahony, would talk too much about the relationship, because for various reasons we can develop, or somebody else will develop, of silence mm-hmm. was the best therapy because of the Civil War and the embarrassment, the trauma and so on. But Mary and Kitty were in Clonakilty on that day, and Tim Patrick mentioned Colin stopping by as if he was sort of saying a final goodbyes to a lot of people on roadsides and everything. But after he had left, this is on the way back from going out as far as Skibbereen, on the way back he stopped at Sam's Cross, which is the Borall's pub, a famous place, just a hill, a quarter of a mile down the hill behind the Borall's is Woodfield, but the road was too narrow for Michael to drive up to it, so he drove up to the Borall's. Johnny Collins, my grandfather, came up from down below, mm-hmm. and meanwhile, and they were there for half an hour or so, and they were leaving there at 6:15 or so p.m., and they, on the way through Clonakilty, among the people they sort of very shortly stopped with was John O'Crowley, who was the photographer and took many of the early pictures of Michael Collins that are now famous, obviously. And inside, by chance, was his two eldest nieces from the Johnny Collins line, Mary and Kitty.
Okay.
And Michael came sweeping into the house, as was his wont anyway. And the lady saw him rushing towards them, because he always picked them up. And he picked up my mother, went to hug her, and she said, "Uncle Michael, I'm too old to be kissed." And she carried that crucible silently for so many years. And then, you know,
what age were you, 11, 12?
She was September 1910, so she was just 12, growing, almost 12.
And she says, "Uncle Michael, I'm too old to be kissed."
Yeah, and then when she was 86 out in Our Lady's Manor in Dalkey, she said shortly before she died, "You know, Michael, just thinking of all those times, and I know your interest in that, mm-hmm. I should have let Uncle Michael kiss me." So that was, she was carrying that all those years.
And then your grandfather, did his Nancy O'Brien, tell us that connection.
Nancy, my direct grandmother, who was the children of all the children born at Woodfield up to Liam Collins, my grandmother was Cathy Hurley from Drina, whose brother Jack, Sean Hurley, was the only corpsman killed in 1916 on Church Street. Wow. He was in the Four Courts Battalion there, and outside the Father Matthew Hall, he was shot. Cathy Hurley had those children right up to Liam in January 1920. And I keep mentioning Liam because he was so critical to the later development of Woodfield and all around. Along with people like Jim Crowley and that. But Johnny married again. He had eight children. The house was burnt in April 1921. There was a diaspora of all those kids. My mother and Mary went up to Horsleap and to Cathy Hurley's sister, Maloney, up in Horsleap, and then went to Ring, and now we're in, as I say, getting their school uniforms to go to Dominican Convent Wicklow. That Nancy O'Brien, who was a second cousin once removed of Johnny's,
Damon
O'Brien, and she had been one of Michael Collins' intelligence officers inside the GPO, and it's a huge story about Nancy O'Brien, an extraordinary lady. And she then became my grandmother afterwards, but she married Johnny, second marriage, in September 2022, very shortly after Michael Collins died. And she took over minding the first family children, and then had two more children, Michal Collins, who for many years, who died in 2000, and was many years the Collins speaker at Bain le Blau every year.
Okay.
And Nancy, two more children in those years.
And was Johnny Collins was widowed, was he?
He was widowed,
yeah.
Because Cathy Hurley died,
yeah,
of TB on the 3rd of February 1921, 2 months before the house was burnt. So this traumatic sad event,
yeah,
for,
yeah,
the whole of that generation of mother dying February, house burnt
to the ground.
My mother particularly talking, you know, about, I wanted to go back into the fire to get my school bag, because I'd be killed at school down in Lisabar the next morning if I didn't have my school bag. And no, not allowed. And the man in charge of that burning section was Major Arthur E. Percival of the Essex Regiment there. And if I may say so, Joe, when I came down as an apprentice and lived with my grandparents, Johnny and Nancy, Nancy said to me, you know, Michael, when we in 1942, February 42, read of the humiliating surrender of the British forces to the Japanese in Singapore,
yeah, of course,
80,000
yeah,
troops, and we heard that the commanding officer was Lieutenant General Arthur E. Percival.
Okay.
We said, there's no road without a turning, and he was there for the burning of the house. But Nancy was...
Captain Arthur Percival, that incredible images, because there was Pathé News then, the Second World War, and there was Pathé News as well around Michael Collins, but it's in black and white. It's been wonderfully colourised by Rob Gross on Twitter, YouTube, if you want to have a look at it. But the Captain Arthur Percival, who surrendered with great ignominy, surrendered to a smaller force, didn't he, in the Second World War?
Yes, the Japanese had come down the Bataan Peninsula behind Singapore. They were expecting to come in by sea, and all the armaments of the British were seawards, but the Japanese had come down and cut their way through the jungle, all Malay and all down through, and had much smaller force. But the surrender just took place at that time, and as I say, that was the sort of
and he led the burning of the Collins household.
Yeah,
and when then they heard of what happened to him, his ignominy and his cowardice. 24 years later, what did they say? There's no road without a turning.
There's no road without a turning. In other words, this vengeance is sweet. It was just one of these.
And Nancy Collins was Nancy O'Brien, as she was then. She was a spy in the GPO in Dublin.
GPO,
which GPO? In Dublin, Cork.
Dublin. She was 1882, and so she was 8 years older than Michael, and she had done the post office exam and been in London at the time. Michael was there as well, along with Hanny, Michael's older sister that he lived with. And she was posted back to Dublin back in, you know, in the period well before 1916, but was involved. And she was delegated by the head of the, if you like, the British Civil Service there, post office, McMahon, and asked to translate, because they saw Michael Collins had been learning about things before the British forces learned themselves,
because of
his spying activities. And he had translated they had a coding, and Miss O'Brien, as she was called in and said, Miss O'Brien, you've been a faithful servant over all these years, and I know you've had nothing to do with these riffraff fighting, and we would like you to do the translations of stuff coming over from Whitehall and from the Department of Defence in England. And she was translating those, and her stories to me and others of our peer group were of hiding, writing second versions of all these messages and tying them up in a bun in the back of her hair, and putting on her hat and strolling out in the proper way and bringing them out to him.
Because everything was on paper. Everything had to be in writing, and there was no other way. Well, and the main phone lines into the country came through the exchange up there beside the Stag's Head, but came through the GPO, and that's where she was getting. And then we go back.
She was posted.
Yeah, and then we go back to Michael Collins in the GPO in 1916. He was in the GPO in 1916, along with Clark and McDermott and McDonough. Pierce Cant was above in St. James's Hospital, James Connolly and Joseph Plunkett. But on the Friday of the 1916 Rising, Michael Collins, the sixth, James Connolly was wounded, so he was being carried by soldiers. Tom Clark, John McDermott, McDonough, Pierce, and Plunkett, and Connolly, and Michael Collins, and Sean Lamass, future Taoiseach, where Bragg came out the side door of the GPO into Moor Lane, around the corner. There's an alleyway still there, straight up to the rotunda. There was the British had a machine gun there. Collins got them across, and then they broke into a house, the home of the McCain family, and one of them accidentally shot Bridget McCain, who was a child. But in that house, which still stands and should forever stand and be memorialised, in that house on that fateful Friday, we had Michael Collins, we had Sean Lamass, we had Pádraig Pearse, we had Thomas Clark, Sean McDermott, Thomas McDonough, as I said, and James Connolly and Joseph Plunkett. An incredible location. There's no other state that can trace its foundation and its heroes for many a long year to that one little spot just off. If you're going up Moor Street, on your right-hand side, there's a little Moor Lane. Well, the McCain household was at the back of the shop that's now in Moor Lane. OK, another break, and I'm going, stay with us, Michael, please. Stay with us, Deirdre Bourke and the Bourke household. Stay with us, Niall Murray. Niall's talking about the house where all the irregulars are planning tonight's attack on the Collins convoy. And after the break, we'll talk to a man whose grandfather was in that convoy.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815. Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
It's now coming just past 25 to 3. Tim, I'll come back to you briefly. Where is Michael Collins heading now? Where's the convoy?
Well, he would be heading over to Roscarbery at that time. Okay. And the convoy would have driven up into the square. And there was a hotel there, and Michael Collins went in there first. And then he went in next door to a MacDonald family, because Ger MacDonald, their brother, had been killed in the fighting in the Civil War just outside of Clonakilty on the 18th of August. And actually last weekend there was a little plaque unveiled on the wall quite close to the spot where that man was killed. And then Ger MacDonald and his family are buried literally yards away from where Michael Collins' family and his mother and his sister and so on in Roscarbery as well. So and of course the convoy would have driven past the remains of the RIC station that Tom Barry's flying column had destroyed the previous year. So all the scars of war were everywhere to be seen.
Incredible. And even that point you make about him having to go into the MacDonald household and commiserate. There was a lot of that. There was a lot of that. Well, former comrades killed. And anyway, stay with us, Tim. Victor Edmonds. Victor, good afternoon.
Hello, Joe.
Your grandfather was, I didn't know this until today when you phoned in, his grandfather was one of the riflemen in the Crossley tender in Michael Collins' convoy.
That's right. Samuel Edmonds was his name.
Yeah.
Born in 1896, died in 1966.
Wow.
And he was a member of the Dublin Guards, and he had only joined up on the 17th of July, so he was only a couple of weeks in the army, mm-hmm. but he had served in the British Army in the First World War, so he was an experienced soldier.
Okay. Because remember, when you were signing up, you were asked if you'd ever fought with a foreign army or indeed had any other experience which helped you. Okay,
that's right.
So is he from Dublin?
He is indeed, yes. Yeah, so he's a tenement boy from the inner city.
Okay.
And
So he's in now, that's the other interesting thing. I'll come back to Tim about this, that a lot of the convoy seemed to be from Dublin and didn't exactly know their way around West Cork on the day, but it was a relatively small convoy. What did your grandfather recall to Charles Edmonds? What did he recall when they both went back to Baile na Blaa?
Yes, my Uncle Charlie lived in London.
Okay.
And he came home for holidays in 1964. And this is his experience. I asked him to write it out because I only discovered this in 2010.
Okay.
his address in Ealing in London.
Yeah.
And the letter is dated the 26th of November 2010. A record of my recollection of a visit to Ballina Blau with my late father, Samuel Edmonds.
Mm.
In the summer of 1964, I was home in Dublin on holidays and in a hired car took my dad away for a few days.
Okay.
We ended up in Cork City and he asked me to take him to Ballina Blau. He had not been there since 1922. We parked and walked the site of the ambush. He pointed out to me where the firing was coming from and the positions of the various participants. He himself believed that Collins had been shot in the back of his head by one of his own men.
Yeah.
He became very emotional and shed some tears, saying that we complained about the way the English had treated the Irish, but that during the Civil War we did awful things to one another. And in inverted commas, particularly to young boys when we caught them.
Yeah.
I will be 87 years of age shortly, but this is my exact memory of that trip so many years ago, signed by Charles Edmonds, who passed away 2 years later.
And his father passed away in 1966, 50 years after the Rising. But 3 months later, 3 months after this, yes, your grandfather took part in a firing squad.
Yes, he was in Beggar's Bush Barracks and he was put on the firing squad that executed Erskine Childers.
Good God.
And it was a peculiar firing squad because it was 15 men, but only 5 of them were given live rounds.
Okay.
And the 5 that were given the live rounds were all ex-British Army soldiers. The officer in charge said, "I got his own crowd to shoot him." His name was O'Connor. He was only 21 years of age, the commanding officer in Beggar's Bush. So it was an awful thing to happen. And the fact that Childers was allowed to shake hands with each of the men of the firing squad was an awful, awful mistake.
Why?
That personalised the whole thing, and it wasn't a military way of doing things. My grandfather never went within a mile of Beggar's Bush Barracks for the rest of his life. And he made one of his sons do a detour so that he wouldn't have to drive past it even. But the other thing to realise, Joe, was that the firing squad was picked about 3 days before they actually carried out the execution because of the legal wrangling that went on by Childers' legal team trying to save his life. So the men knew for 3 days that they had to do this. So, it was dreadful. But
and Erskine Childers also, he obtained a promise from his then 16-year-old son, the future President of Ireland, also called Erskine Hamilton Childers, to seek out and shake the hand of every man who had signed his death sentence. His final word spoken to the firing squad, this is 100 years ago, a few months hence, take a step or two forward, lads, it will be easier that way. What an incredible story, Victor Edmonds. What an incredible story. And with your permission, we'll put that, because that's a new piece of information about him being in the Crossley tender. Helen Collins, thank you, Victor. That's Victor Edmonds. Thank you so much. Thank you so much for contacting us. Helen Collins. Helen, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joe. Oh, my God, that was the most heartbreaking
story.
Terrible. The terribleness of war, isn't it?
And then I'm thinking, Beggar's Bush Barracks, Helen, which is still there. It's now magnificent.
Yeah.
It's a comet. It's apartments and it's now a magnificent print museum. But Beggar's Bush Barracks is where James Connolly served when he came to Ireland as a British soldier back in the 1890s. And if you go out Beggar's Bush Barracks and you go to your left, you go on to Northumberland Road where there's still a bus stop. And it's at that bus stop where James Connolly met his future wife. It's incredible, all the connections.
It is. And it just shows how strongly we're all connected, and particularly through the War of Independence, particularly through the Civil War, why it was such a dreadful war. Yeah.
And is that one of the, I won't go into it, Helen, because I know the family don't, and most people don't, understandably. But is that horror one of the reasons why people have say, no, we don't want to find out who fired the shot. We don't think.
Oh, absolutely. I love listening to my cousin Michael O'Mahony. My grandfather was Johnny Collins as well, and my dad is Liam Collins. He was the last Collins born in Woodfield, and he was actually only 12 months old, just over 12 months old, when his mother died, when Cathy Hurley, my grandmother, died.
Okay.
And then, as Michael described, then 6 weeks later, 2 months later, the house was burned down by the General Percival and the Black and Tans. So, and then, of course, the next year, Michael Collins was killed. So it was like trauma on trauma on trauma.
Yeah.
So, it was too hard to talk about those things. I think the first talk I ever gave at Béal na Bláth after Uncle Michael died, Michael O'Mahony referred to him, was the amazement I had when I sat down to think about this. How did they get up the next morning, so as to speak, after the Civil War? Like, the people were incredible to try and put the pieces back together again after such a terrible war. Yeah, and I think they couldn't talk about it, because to talk about it was too painful. I have a great, great friend whose dad fought on the other side. And sometimes it's late at night when we talk about it, you know, because it's too hard.
Yeah.
You know.
In hushed tones. And then there's more connections. Your father, Liam, was taught by Sinead Devalier. Is that correct?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Like, I really want to say that my dad never, and my grandfather, to the best of my knowledge, never believed for one second that De Valera had anything to do with Michael Collins' death. I just wanted to be plain about that.
Yeah, yeah.
And because, obviously, my dad lost his mother very early in life, and then Nancy O'Brien became our grandmother, the most wonderful and beautiful woman. And when Johnny, was arrested the day the house was burnt in Woodfield, and he was put on to Spike Island, and he had previously had a bad farming injury, yeah. And then that festered out in Spike Island, wasn't attended to, so he couldn't go back to farming. So he moved the family to Dublin. They lived in Booterstown Avenue, and around the corner, of course, lived the De Valeras.
Yeah.
And Daddy's Irish teacher was Banny De Valera, and he loved her. Like, to the day of his death, his eyes went soft when he spoke about her. But it was really interesting. He'd say, he would go to the door, and De Valera was Taoiseach at the time, obviously, and he'd go to the door, and if the light was on in the front room, that meant De Valera was at home. And if it wasn't on, that meant he had straight passage to the back sitting room where Banny Dev had the fire lighting and all the rest. He said there was a touch of running the gauntlet, like to get into the inner sanctum with Banny Dev. Do you know, it was...
And Helen, is it true that the men involved in the ambush that are now sitting, as I'll go back to Niall Murray, they're sitting in Niall Murray's house at this time, and they're deciding and planning and what to do 5 hours hence. Well, they didn't know what time Michael Collins was going to come back through again, but they're planning in the house as we speak. Is it true that afterwards they went to your grandfather Johnny, who's Michael's older brother, to seek forgiveness?
Some of them did, and he forgave them. And you know the story about Jim Hurley, who asked to be buried. He was one of the people in the ambush. Yeah. He asked to be buried next to my grandfather, and he's buried next to Nana and Grandy in St. Mary's Cemetery in Clonakilty.
Incredible.
Yeah,
incredible.
And we were raised, and I know Michael will agree, Michael O'Mahony will agree with all of this, we were raised on the basis that this was a tragic war and people get killed in a war.
Yeah.
And that, of course, it was a huge loss to our family that he was killed, like a personal total tragedy, but it was the loss to the country, really, I think. And my father always saw it that way. He lived all his life trying to build bridges and build that divide. Yeah. Michael O'Mahony referred earlier to the Woodfield centenary of Michael Collins' birth, and like, obviously the farm went out of the Collins hands. It was Johnny's farm then when they moved to Dublin.
Okay.
And shortly before 1990, the Coakley family, who owned Woodfield, gave it back to Daddy. And Daddy determined that he would restore it. No, he didn't want to build anything that wasn't there before. the only actual addition he ever made to the site was to put a roof on the what would have become the outhouse, the house that Michael Collins was born. And he sourced the slates for the roof from Balnaspittle Church, and they were of the same era because it had to be slated to preserve the building.
And it's still there, and it's lovingly.
And then Cumann Seanchus Cloch na Cuilte and Mr. O'Donovan and Trailuk Deneen and Tim Crowley and all volunteers and all of us. Of course, we all had to do our bit.
We restored
the whole place, and it's just the most wonderful place
it
to go
really
to.
It is the place to go, actually.
Yeah. Oh, it's, well it's a place Tim of Crowley's. Love and life. Love and life.
Helen, gula mida maha gula gaza yeshte gureva anam dealish, and thank you, as we say that for so many people who died in this country in wars of various names and nomenclatures. Helen Collins, thank you so much. Gula mida maha gula.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Joe Duffy!
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
And we're moving forward in time through this afternoon. We're getting closer to the time of the fateful ambush in the car. Sitting beside the open car, Michael Collins, was Emmett Dalton.
Personally, I was holding the body of the Commander-in-Chief in my arms, and the rest of the cortege was moving ahead as best they could. And it was a sad, sad journey. When we arrived in the city of Cork, there was consternation at my headquarters. My doctor attached to my division, and he took charge of the body. I had to get in touch with headquarters in Dublin. This took a roundabout route because I had to send, we were working on shortwave radios. I had to get in touch with Waterville. And the message went from Waterville by cable to New York and back from New York to London, from London to Dublin. And that's how the message was received in Dublin. We were ordered to take the body back by boat, which was the method of transport anyhow at that time. And on the afternoon, the evening, we proceeded down to the Keys. And the remains were taken on board at evening tide. We started our sorrowful journey down the river. There were tears all over the place. I mean, everybody was grief-stricken, including even the members of the crew and the members of the guard that were on doing honour to the chieftain. The boat proceeded very slowly down the River Lee. And when we were coming out into the harbour, I was surprised to notice that the British destroyer fleet was in line astern and dressed, the troop, their sailors dressed along. And we were greeted with a salute of trumpets, general salute. And this was fantastic over the waves, unbelievable. At any time, music is resounding over a big water space. And as we quietly went further on, they saluted and then they sounded the last post. And I have that memory with me still. It always will be.
It was Emmett Dalton. This is Mary Claire Collins Powell, a grandniece of the big family.
He went to Macroom in the afternoon and returned in the evening to the Imperial Hotel to have tea with his sister, Mary Collins Powell, and her 17-year-old son, Sean, who was then a company sergeant in the Free State Army. My grandmother queried the wisdom of going anywhere because of this appalling cold. They were to travel in 8-cylinder open touring car. My father was more than anxious to accompany him, and he was brusquely told, "I've got my job to do and you have yours." The next day, Tuesday the 22nd of August, is well recorded. My father first saw the body in the Shallachin Hospital, and this time he was allowed to accompany him on his last journey.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Joe Duffy!
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Tim Crowley, fast forward now till after 6 o'clock this evening and the fateful ambush.
Well, Michael Collins left Bandon at around 7 o'clock that evening, the Munster Arms, now the Munster Arms Hotel, and he had a meeting in there with his local army commander, Sean Hales, great friend as well, and of course 8 miles out the road beyond the Blah, the commander of the anti-treaty ambush party was Tom Hales, Sean's brother. So he had two brothers literally on the opposite side that evening.
So often it happened.
Yeah, and the convoy, the actual ambush was called off at the time Michael Collins and his men came into to Bay on the Blah. Most of the IRA lads had gone down to the pub, actually, a half mile away for a drink. And what was left was 6 or 8 men up at the top of the S-bins removing the mines and taking away the barricade. And when Michael Collins' convoy, where the monument is now, the actual ambush was set up at the top of the S, about maybe 300 or 400 meters beyond that. When the lead vehicles of the convoy got up to the top of the S, there was an exchange of fire between both sides. Mm-hmm. And the IRA got off the road very quickly onto the high road and the convoys left. And when Michael Collins' car came around the bend where the monument is now, the windscreen shattered and the side panels were hit with bullets from the anti-treaty lads up on the high road. Emmett Dalton roared at the driver to drive like hell, but Collins said, no, stop and we'll fight them. And all of Michael Collins' convoy stopped, returning the fire. And at one point then, the anti-treaty IRA men were being chased up on the high road and the convoys left by Michael Collins' men who'd gone on to the end of that road, and they were pushing the anti-treaty lads backwards. And when they came to a certain point, the gunner in the armoured car at the back of the Collins convoy in the road below spotted them, and he opened fire with his Vickers machine gun, and the anti-treaty lads were pinned down for a while. And the next thing, the Vickers machine gun jammed and the IRA up on the high road began to run off, and Michael Collins could see that from where he was on the lower road, and he ran to the back of the armoured car. And then he shouted forward to his own men, look, lads, they're running up the road. And with that, Michael Collins just stepped out onto the open road behind the armoured car. We think about 15 yards behind it was where he was standing, firing his rifle off the shoulder, and he was shot in the head.
Stays open until 3:15 p.m. or email joe@rte.ie.